Good morning. Please be seated. The first matter on the calendar this morning is Berkeley Reed Lewis versus State of Minnesota. Council, when you approach the podium, please identify yourselves for us and the record. Council for appellant may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney from the State Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing Berkeley Lewis on this appeal. This appeal presents two basic issues for this court. First, did the district court in this case improperly interfere in plea negotiations and cede its sentencing authority prior to Mr. Lewis's sentencing? And second, should the district court in this case have held an evidentiary hearing? Because if the court had accepted the allegations and the petition as true, they would have provided a ground for Mr. Lewis to have relief. I'd like to begin today with the first issue regarding whether the court interfered in plea negotiations and ceded its sentencing authority. The Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure and the case law of this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court define separation of powers principles that apply to district courts and to the prosecutor's office. Essentially, the county attorney has authority over charging decisions and over the plea negotiation process, while the district court has authority over sentencing.
Counsel, you've raised a number of issues, and you're entitled to discuss them in the order in which you wish. Since you're choosing that issue first, I'm assuming you think it's one of your strongest. I'm curious about what in particular you think the district court did in violating the separation of powers.
Sure. Well, under Wheeler, which was decided while this post-conviction was pending, but in March of 2018, the Minnesota Supreme Court stated that a judge's function in the plea process is limited to approving or rejecting a plea submitted by the parties for judicial acceptance. Our position is that the district court in this case went far beyond that limited role in plea negotiations.
Far beyond the facts in Wheeler, you mean? Is that maybe I misunderstood?
Far beyond Wheeler's.
You're using Wheeler where there was the judge gave unsolicited feedback.
We're using the principle that the holding in Wheeler that a judge's function is limited to approving or rejecting the plea agreement as.
So specifically here, the judge reiterated what was on the table. What was it that the judge did that was over and above just stating, this is where it's at?
Well, the judge in this case incorrectly stated what would occur if
what was incorrect?
Four main things were incorrect with what the judge did. First, the judge mischaracterized the effect on the plea agreement if Mr. Lewis had argued for a stay of imposition. Here the parties agreed for a guideline sentence. The PSI recommended a stay of imposition and before sentencing.
I thought the judge specifically asked the attorney, does he want a stay of imposition? And the reply from counsel was no.
The judge stated that the effect of arguing for a stay of imposition would be the automatic consequence that the plea agreement would be rescinded, the guilty plea that Mr. Lewis had already entered would be vacated, and the state would automatically charge him with attempted murder. All of those statements were incorrect. Him arguing for a stay of imposition would not have placed him in violation of the plea agreement. The plea agreement was to a guideline sentence. Under the guideline sentence in this case was a stayed sentence of 21 months. Although the mandatory minimum could have applied, that had to be based on either a sentencing trial in compliance with Blakely or based on Mr. Lewis's waiver of his Blakely rights and admission. Here, neither of those things occurred. So the guideline sentence remained a stayed sentence. So if Mr. Lewis had argued for a stay of imposition at sentencing, he would not have been in violation of the plea agreement. So the court was incorrect on that first point, that arguing for a stay of imposition, as the PSI recommended, would have placed Mr. Lewis in breach of the plea agreement.
Are you saying that the sentence to which the parties agreed in the plea agreement was an upward departure?
It was, because those findings were not made by the court And because Mr. Lewis did not waive his Blakely rights, and because the Blakely trial was not held, yes, it would have been an upward departure.
Would have been or was an upward departure?
It was an upward departure.
Is a statutory mandatory sentence like that an upward departure? That's not my recollection.
In Barker, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that the application of mandatory minimum under provisions that provide for if the crime is committed with a weapon, and that's the triggering for the mandatory minimum, that under Barker, Blakely findings, it has to follow the Blakely procedure. Either there has to be a Blakely trial or a waiver. So it is subject to Blakely, the triggering of the mandatory minimum. And that's really the key point in this case, that the presumptive sentence remained a state sentence.
I didn't see an argument in your brief that there was a Blakely violation.
We aren't arguing at this time. We're arguing that as a factual matter, the court mischaracterized the effect of Mr. Lewis arguing for a stay of imposition. It would have been consistent with the plea agreement. I mean, that's the key point for our legal argument. Making that argument sentencing wouldn't have put him in breach of the plea agreement, so it wouldn't have necessarily provided a basis for the state to move to vacate the plea. So that's the first inaccuracy the court made. The second inaccuracy is that the court stated that it would be an automatic consequence of him making that argument that the state would get its plea back. The state does not have an automatic right to withdraw from a plea agreement. In limited situations, the state may move to vacate a plea that a defendant has entered, but although a defendant has an automatic right to withdraw from a plea if a court imposes a sentence inconsistent with the plea agreement, the state does not have a similar right. What the state would have had to do is if it felt that Mr. Lewis had breached the plea agreement, it would have had to move to vacate the guilty plea, and then it would have been up to the court whether or not to grant that motion. The court mischaracterized that as a fait accompli, as an automatic consequence of what would happen if Mr. Lewis had made that argument, when in fact it was subject to the court's discretion. The third inaccuracy that the court provided Mr. Lewis was that the state would automatically amend to charge him with attempted murder. Amendment at that stage would have been something that the state would have to achieve through a motion, and again, the court would have had discretion whether or not to grant that motion to amend the complaint. Even if the court had granted the motion to amend the complaint, Mr. Lewis still could have moved to dismiss the charge as lacking probable cause. At this stage, the court didn't know anything about the specific allegations the state was going to make to support a potential attempted murder charge. So it was inaccurate for the court to say that would have been an automatic consequence. And finally, the court mischaracterized the risk of that attempted murder charge. The court stated that Mr. Lewis would be subject to a presumptive sentence of 20 years if convicted of attempted murder. In fact, even if he was convicted of first-degree attempted murder, the presumptive sentence would have been 15 years. And this is all problematic, and this was addressed in Wheeler, but because the court, by joining with the state essentially and trying to persuade Mr. Lewis not to take action to threaten the plea agreement, the court was giving the weight of its judicial authority and placing it behind the state and behind the plea agreement reached by the parties. And this had an inherently coercive effect on Mr. Lewis. It was already, there was already a great disparity between the charge he pleaded to, which called for a 21-month sentence, and attempted murder, which called for a 15-year sentence. But for the court then to say that attempted murder charge would automatically follow and that it would actually lead to a 20-year sentence on Mr. Lewis if he was convicted, that really created a heavy pressure on Mr. Lewis and pushed him into maintaining a plea agreement in this case.
I'm looking at the petition for post-conviction relief. Am I right or wrong that you did not make this argument that you're making to us in that petition?
We did make the argument. We argued that the court improperly interfered in plea negotiations. We didn't cite the specific fact regarding the presumptive sentence, but the legal issue has been the same throughout this case, that the court improperly interfered by mischaracterizing the state's ability to withdraw from the plea, by mischaracterizing the possibility of an attempted murder charge. So we've had the same legal issue. So we'd argue that there was, I know the state argued that we waived this issue, but what we're asking this court to do is to look at the full record. We're pointing to specific facts in this appeal that weren't cited in the petition, but that doesn't change that the legal issues remain the same. And this court on appeal may look at the entire factual record to reach the correct legal conclusion, and that's what we're asking for in this case. Turning to the second issue, the court here decided not to hold a hearing in this case, and in reaching that conclusion, it rejected Mr. Lewis's the allegations Mr. Lewis made in his petition as being inconsistent with the plea record, and it's our position that by doing that, the court failed to apply the proper standard for review before summarily denying a post-conviction petition. Minnesota Supreme Court has repeatedly held that before denying a post-conviction petition without a hearing, the district court must accept the allegations and the petition as true. It must construe the facts in the record in the light most favorable to the legal claims made in the petition, and it may not make any credibility determinations. Here, the court violated all three of those principles. First, it did not accept Mr. Lewis's allegation as true that he, in fact, could not remember the incident and had pleaded guilty only out of fear of a potential attempted murder charge. Instead, the court credited previous statements made in the plea. So it did not accept that factual allegation as true. And in resolving the conflict between the plea transcript and Mr. Lewis's petition, it resolved that conflict in a way adverse to the claims made in the petition. So that in doing that, the court did not construe the facts in the record in the light most favorable to the claims in the petition. Finally, the court found that Mr. Lewis's claims in his petition were not credible, and again, that was an improper credibility determination. So in this case, there were factual disputes the legal issues, if the court had accepted the allegations as Mr. Lewis presented them, it did provide grounds for relief, and the court denied that based on improper factual determinations. So we'd ask at least for a remand in this case, so the court can hold a hearing and we can have a full evaluation of the facts in this case.
If we did have a remand, would the attorney who represented the appellant at that time state to the court that his agreement was different than that if he didn't go to prison for the 21 months, that was still within the confines of the agreement?
Yes, that's one. That Mr. Duggins could be a witness at the hearing.
But would he say that?
According,
it sounds to me like the parties understood the agreement, and the agreement that they seem to have understood is the same that the judge understood.
Mr. Duggins made a statement that that his understanding was that the agreement did allow for arguing for a stay of imposition. Now, by the time sentencing occurred and the judge had clarified his position that would put Mr. Lewis in violation of the plea agreement, at that time the parties believed that arguing for a stay of imposition would have put them in violation of the plea agreement. But if there was a hearing, we could get additional explanation from Mr. Duggins about what his understanding of the plea agreement was. It would also allow Mr. Lewis to more fully explain what he stated in his affidavit. At the very least, we'd ask for a hearing in this case to address those issues. And what was especially problematic from our perspective on this case was that the court not only denied a hearing, but also went beyond the record in the court's order and really got into a lot of his internal reasoning and thought process during this case that led him to rule in important ways in this case. A lot of that material, in our view, was factual. It's really the type of thing that should have that Mr. Lewis should have had the opportunity to respond to, and it really shouldn't have been something that the court added to the record on its own without it being raised by either of the parties. So that was an additional problem with the order, in our view, in this case.
I have a question. You indicated in the post-conviction petition that the judge denied the request for a 2002 examination because the court found that it was untimely. And then in the memorandum of law supporting the petition, you fill that out with some additional information, which is the fact that the district court said, you're taking over as new counsel after your client has already entered his plea of guilty. This request for a 2002 examination is not timely unless you wish to move to your client wishes to withdraw the plea. And then you withdrew the request for the Rule 2002 examination. So now you're asking us for the relief to withdraw the plea. Why didn't you proceed then?
Well,
to withdraw the plea. I mean, the court was essentially telling you, look, move to withdraw the plea, and then I'll consider your request for Rule 2002, suggesting at least right. to me that the court wasn't really denying the request. He was just saying procedurally, this doesn't make sense. You're not asking to withdraw the plea.
We agree that on the Rule 2002 issue, the court did give an opportunity for plea withdrawal. It's our position that counsel was still ineffective initially for failing to develop that defense. But we do agree that the court did.
Now you're the attorney, though,
right?
With the post-conviction petition, and you're given an opportunity.
Right, and we're asking for plea withdrawal at this stage. But again, I mean, I'm
talking about that stage before
right.
the district court.
Well, I don't think we can't disentangle the plea withdrawal issue from what the judge did. I mean, the main thrust of our appeal is that the judge didn't allow Mr. Lewis to withdraw his plea. It's that the judge mischaracterized the consequences if Mr. Lewis did withdraw his plea. And a big part of that was mischaracterizing the attempted murder.
That's for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. This morning, I will try to address the issues in the same order that Mr. McLaughlin did. So I will start with the claim that Judge Bryan improperly interfered with the plea negotiations and ceded his sentencing authority to the state. I want to build on something that Judge Shalas just asked, which was two of the, I guess, factual arguments, if we want to characterize them, is that we're waived by not being presented in the post-conviction petition, not being discussed in the supporting memorandum that was submitted to the post-conviction court, and really depriving Judge Bryan completely of creating any findings or any ruling on those issues. This court is here reviewing a post-conviction order, and there's nothing in that order about these arguments. And that's why there's clear case law saying that in many post-conviction appeals, when new arguments are raised at the appellate level as opposed to the post-conviction level, they are waived. The Robinson case from the Minnesota Supreme Court that I cite on page 18 of my brief, I don't see how that can be distinguished from what we have here, and opposing counsel has not even tried to do so. In Robinson, the petitioner alleged in his post-conviction petition that he received ineffective assistance of appellate counsel in his direct appeal because that attorney failed to raise the issue of whether the trial judge erred by not giving a lesser included instruction. In the post-conviction petition, he did not name which lesser included instruction he was talking about, a very specific fact, but obviously still presented the overall ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim in his petition. Then on appeal from that denial of the post-conviction petition, the petitioner filled in and said that he was, what his appellate counsel should have asked was a first-degree manslaughter instruction. However, the Supreme Court refused to review that claim on its merits because, quote, it was not raised below and the claim was not properly before the court. Again, the only difference in that situation was the specific lesser-included instruction was not named in the post-conviction petition. Here, yes, we have an umbrella claim made in the post-conviction petition that Judge Bryan improperly interfered with plea negotiations, but he was never presented with the arguments that the sentence, according to appellant's view, was actually a presumptively stayed one, or that the appellant was misinformed about the potential length of the attempted murder charge. And so running quickly through those four points that I believe Mr. McLaughlin raised, if this court were inclined to get to the merits of any of them, mischaracterizing the plea agreement, we are talking about an alleged Blakely violation here, because the argument would be that appellant did not waive his right to have a jury determine whether he used a dangerous weapon, which then would require the imposition of the enhanced sentence under Section 60911, Subdivision 4. But there's no Blakely error here, because the use of a dangerous weapon, which would justify the application of 60911, Subdivision 4, is also an element of the second-degree assault charge that petitioner validly pled guilty to. So there was no need, maybe under some view, there was a need for a separate Blakely waiver, but the fact, under the state's position, in my understanding of Barker and the controlling case law, the fact that the element that justifies the enhanced sentence under the guidelines is also an element of the underlying charge means that there's no Blakely violation. Meaning, Judge Bryan was correct to believe and to state on the record that the defendant's request for a stayed probationary sentence was not consistent with the guidelines and not consistent with the plea agreement. The sentencing guidelines in Section 2EB1 and then at Comment 2E01 clearly state that when 60911 is involved, that the presumptive commitment is prison as opposed to a stayed sentence, or presumptive disposition is commitment, excuse me, and it should be for whatever the guidelines grid reflects, which in this case would be 21 months. And there is a footnote in the reply brief about on page 5 about the state not requesting the mandatory minimum that was charged in the original complaint with the count that appellant ultimately pled guilty to, so he had clear notice, and that's why the parties had the understanding, and Judge Bryan clearly made the implicit finding that a guideline sentence in this case was a commitment to prison. Briefly, because I do want to spend a little bit of time on what we're treating as a second issue here today, but those remaining points about withdrawing from the plea agreement, well, and also I guess, adding a count of attempted murder. It sounds like Mr. McLaughlin's position is that Judge Bryan was jumping the gun to an extent, and he was indicating what was going to be happening without going through the process of the state making the formal request and him in his discretion, you know, making the rulings on what would happen. They just came from a chambers conference at that December 31st, 2015 hearing. They had just discussed what was going to be happening, and Judge Bryan, if anything, was indicating how he was going to be exercising that discretion there.
When Judge Bryan summarized it, each attorney was given an opportunity to correct or expand on any summary, weren't they?
They were, and appellant's counsel at that time was John Baker, who was a new attorney compared to the one who had handled the plea, did not correct Judge Bryan in the slightest. And lastly, on the point in terms of the maximum sentence for the attempted murder, it sounds like an argument that Judge Bryan exaggerated the harm that appellant would have faced if he had sought a stayed sentence by, you know, moving to withdraw his plea and going to trial on all the counts, including the attempted murder what was going to be added. Well, it's accurate to say that 20 years would be the maximum sentence, just not the maximum sentence based on appellant's specific criminal history score. And of course, you know from your trial court experience, Your Honors, that at this point, because a conviction had not been entered, a plea had not been entered on the attempted murder case, there was no sentencing guideline worksheet in front of Judge Bryan in which he could easily look down and say exactly what the presumptive sentence was. And we're talking about a difference between 18 years and 20 years because with a criminal history score of 0 that appellant had at the time, the presumptive range would have been up to 216 months, which again is 18 years. Of course, we also have the testimony from appellant at his plea hearing, which he said under oath that he was pleading guilty because he was guilty and not because of the attempted murder charge that the state had indicated it would be adding if the case proceeded to trial. And lastly, any claim that the attempted murder charge somehow rendered the plea involuntary fails as a matter of law, as because the Minnesota Supreme Court held in Ecker, which I cite in my brief, that a defendant's motivation to avoid a more serious penalty or more serious charge will not invalidate a guilty plea. In Ecker, they found that the plea was voluntarily given. With the time I have remaining, unless there are further questions on the interference of plea negotiations issue, I will turn to what I treated in my brief as the first issue, and that's about the denial of the evidentiary hearing on this post-conviction petition. There's a fundamental difference between a third-party witness at trial who allegedly recants his or her testimony versus a criminal defendant who later wishes to take back his or her own sworn guilty plea years later. Ruling for an appellant under these facts would require a full-fledged post-conviction evidentiary hearing every time a defendant later regrets pleading guilty and files an affidavit claiming that he did not mean what he previously testified to under oath. I understand the rule is that when a post-conviction petitioner seeks to withdraw his guilty plea based on a factual averment or a claim in a post-conviction filing, they should receive an evidentiary hearing if that claim is not contradicted by their own sworn testimony contained in existing transcripts, files, and records of the proceeding, and if it were true, it would establish one of the three required components of a valid guilty plea, that it was involuntary, that it was unintelligent, or that it was inaccurate. For instance, Judge Bryan in this case would have had to grant an evidentiary hearing if appellant had claimed that his attorney had misadvised him off the record about something along the lines of a deportation consequence in violation of Padilla. Or Judge Bryan would have had to grant an evidentiary hearing if in his petition, appellant had claimed that the prosecutor had threatened to prosecute everyone in appellant's family if he didn't plead guilty. But that's not what we have here. And unlike those examples, what we have is a narrow situation in which the defendant's own sworn testimony at the time of his plea hearing, which is part of the files and records of a proceeding, conclusively shows the relevant factual determination. This happened in this case, just like it also happened in this court's decision in the Williams case that I cite in my brief, in which the defendant's attorney, I guess the claim in Williams was that the defendant's attorney told him that he would receive a probationary sentence. And obviously, the plea hearing transcript and the plea petition in Williams clearly established the opposite, so that the defendant was not, in that case, entitled to an evidentiary hearing. Another example would be a claim by a defendant that his attorney never told him how long a sentence would be that he was going to be facing, when, if you look back, the plea hearing transcript makes abundantly clear that that individual defendant was informed of the maximum possible sentence. The issue in this case is not the credibility of what appellant claimed in his post-conviction affidavit. It's whether there's enough on the record for a valid guilty plea. Appellant provides a couple of reasons why his guilty plea should be allowed to be withdrawn in this case. One of those is that he could not remember the offense, and another is a claim that he falsely confessed based on the threats that he would face an attempted murder charge unless he pled guilty. But the record clearly shows that appellant recalled and admitted sufficient facts when he pled guilty, and Judge Bryan found these personal, sworn, under oath admissions were credible because otherwise he would not have accepted the guilty plea in the first place. And appellant's claim that his plea was involuntary based on the prospect that he was going to be facing an attempted murder charge, as I said before, fails as a matter of law under Ecker. I understand that Williams is unpublished, but it was decided within the last 6 months. It addressed a very similar post-conviction claim, effectively, ignore what I said under oath at my own plea hearing and listen to what I'm claiming now in a post-conviction filing made years later. And this court obviously wants to be consistent in its decisions, and the explanation in Williams about why the improper credibility determination line of cases embodied by Anderson and Henderson and other cases cited in the party's briefs, why that does not apply to a situation like we have here, I find that explanation very persuasive, and I urge this panel to be consistent with Williams. Furthermore, in the time that I have left, I just want to make a couple points that were touched on in the briefs, and that this ruling in Williams and the state's position here is consistent with the plain language of the post-conviction statute. Section 59004, subdivision 1, talks about, you know, unless the files and records of a proceeding conclusively shows. Well, what we have here is the files and records of the proceeding conclusively showing that appellant did remember what he did back in July of 2015 as he admitted sufficient facts to constitute the crime of second-degree assault. And the only case that appellant relies on that involves a guilty plea compared to all of these trials where you later had third-party witnesses who were recanting or newly discovered evidence or things of that nature, the only case that defendant cites that involves a guilty plea is Matakis. And, of course, in Matakis, the Supreme Court affirmed the denial of that post-conviction petition without a hearing. I guess I would encourage this court, if you have any pause about the state's position, to read the Coolin decision, which I cite in my brief. It's a Supreme Court case from 1970, and in that case, the Supreme Court cites one of its slightly older decisions, Becker v. Tehash from 1963, and there is a quote, again in the Coolin decision, from the Tehash decision, and that is, the fatal deficiency of the petition is that the allegation that his plea was induced by promises or threats is in direct conflict with petitioner's testimony when he entered the plea. Everything the petitioner is claiming right now is in direct conflict with what he testified to under oath at the plea hearing. And unless there are any further questions, I would simply ask that you affirm the denial of the post-conviction petition in this case. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you. First, the Minnesota Supreme Court has unequivocally held without qualification that a post-conviction court in any case before it is to view the lights in a manner or view the facts in the light most favorable to the petition, to accept the allegations made in the petition as true, and to not make credibility determinations before summarily denying the petition. There's no rule that the Minnesota Supreme Court has announced that respondent proposes it in this case. There's no special rule for when the factual allegations come from the petitioner himself. It's a general rule. It's based in summary judgment principles that whatever the source of the allegations are in the complaint, a district court should accept those as true when deciding whether or not it should deny relief based on the law. Here, the court did not do that. There's no way to read what happened in this case without concluding that the court did not accept the allegations that Mr. Lewis made in the petition as true. It also is indisputable that the court did not view the record in the light most favorable to the legal claims in the petition. So the rule that the state proposes here is really one that has no basis in the case law and has no basis in the statute. So we'd ask the court not to apply that standard and instead to apply the rule that that applies in any post-conviction proceeding and find it applies here.
How would we have finality in pleas, though, if a defendant could say, I plead guilty, Your Honor, and I admit all the elements of this offense, and now 2 years later, I really didn't do it, so you should give me a hearing. It seems like we'd be overwhelmed with hearings on very frivolous matters.
Well, the state raises that similar issue when we're talking about efficiency of this and that the rule that the state proposes promotes efficiency. The
Part of it is a question of sort of short-term efficiency versus long-term efficiency. Allowing a defendant to have a hearing on a claim that the plea was not valid, although that would put an initial burden on the court to hold a hearing, it would promote finality by allowing the defendant to fully develop the record, allow the court to make a determination based on a full record. So it would narrow the issues that then were litigated on appeal and further through the process. With what happened here, where the case was denied without a hearing, even though there was a factual dispute, this court is left with an incomplete record. There's still litigation. You know, Mr. Lewis is still not satisfied with his plea, but there hasn't been the fair hearing that the rule envisions and that the Minnesota Supreme Court has also said should be held. So, although there's a short-term benefit in efficiency by not holding a hearing on the grounds proposed by respondent, we'd argue that in the long run, it undermines efficiency, it undermines finality to not give that hearing. And really, this whole case is the story of the district court trying to, in the interest of short-term efficiency, not following judicial procedures. In the long run, it has undermined the finality of Mr. Lewis's plea. If the district court would have, from the beginning, strictly followed the procedures by, maintaining its strict role as the sentencing entity and not getting involved in plea negotiations, Mr. Lewis would have had the opportunity at the time of his plea to fully evaluate what he wanted to do. And a lot of the issues that have been raised in this post-conviction would have been addressed at that time. In the interest of the short-term benefit of maintaining the plea, the court overstepped its authority and got involved in plea negotiations, and that had the long-term effect of undermining finality, undermining efficiency. And really, the rule that respondent proposes does the same thing. It asks a court, or it proposes that a court should be allowed to summarily deny a petition if the only facts are alleged by the petitioner. Although that would save the court the burden of a hearing, in the long run, it's going to increase litigation in this court. It's going to reduce finality of convictions and development of the record. So we would ask this court to follow the plain language of the statute, the plain language of Anderson and Henderson, and hold that district court needs to look at a petition in the light most favorable to the petitioner, and that the court did not do that in this case, and the case should be remanded for a hearing.
Thank you. The matter is taken under advisement.